Tom Huckabee lived in King, the other boys' dorm in our complex. Becca Aubert lived in Franklin. They had become quite cozy in the last 3 or 4 weeks, and that included taking their meals together. They were coming back from breakfast on that snowy, late November morning when they saw something printed on the north side of Chamberlain Hall. That was the side which faced the rest of the campus, which faced East Annex in particular, where the big corporations held their job interviews. They walked closer, stepping off the path and into the new snow. By then about 4 inches had fallen. "Look," Becca said, pointing down at the snow. There were queer tracks there, not footprints, but drag marks almost, and deep punched holes running in lines outside them. Tom Huckabee said they reminded him of tracks made by a person wearing skis and wielding ski poles. Neither of them thought that someone using crutches might have made such tracks. Not then. They drew closer to the side of the dorm. The letters there were big and black, but by then the snow was so heavy that they had to get within 10 feet of the wall before they could read the words, which had been posted by someone with a can of spray paint, and in a state of total piss-off from the jagged look of the message. Again, neither of them considered that someone trying to spray-paint a message while at the same time maintaining his balance on a set of crutches might not be able to manage much in the way of neatness. The message read, "Fuck Johnson, killer president, U.S. out of Vietnam now." It was flanked by a couple of peace signs. I've read that some criminals, perhaps a great many criminals, actually want to be caught. I think that was the case with Stoke Jones. Whatever he had come to the University of Maine looking for, he wasn't finding it. I believe he decided it was time to leave, and if he was going, he would make the grandest gesture a guy on crutches could manage before he did. Tom Huckabee told dozens of kids about what was spray-painted on our dorm. So did Becca Aubert. One of the people, she told, was Franklin's second-floor proctor, a skinny, self-righteous girl named Marjorie Stuttenheimer. Marjorie became quite a figure on campus by 1969 as founder and president of Christians for College America. The CCA supported the war in Vietnam, and at their booth in the Memorial Union sold the little lapel flag pins which Richard Nixon made so popular. I was scheduled to work Thursday lunch at the Palace on the Plains, and while I might cut classes, it never crossed my mind to cut my job. I wasn't made that way. I gave my seat in the lounge to Tony DeLuca and started over to Holyoke at about 11 o'clock to do my dishly duty. I saw a fairly large group of students gathered in the snow, looking at something on the north side of my dorm. I walked over, read the message, and knew at once who'd put it there. On Bennett Road, a blue University of Maine sedan and one of the university's two police cars were drawn up by the path leading to Chamberlain's side door. Margie Stuttenheimer was there, part of a little group that consisted of four campus cops, the dean of men, and Charles Ebersole, the university's disciplinary officer. There were perhaps 50 people in the crowd when I joined it at the rear. In the 5 minutes I stood there rubbernecking, it swelled to 75. By the time I finished wipe-down shutdown at 1:15 and headed back to Chamberlain, there were probably 200 people gawping in little clusters. I suppose it's hard to believe now that any graffiti could have such a draw, especially on a shitty day like that one, but we are talking about a far different world, one where no magazine in America, except very occasionally Popular Photography, would show a nude so nude that the subject's pubic hair was on view, where no newspaper would dare so much as a whisper about any political figure's sex life. This was before Atlantis sank. This was long ago and far away, in a world where at least one comedian was jailed for uttering fuck in public, and another observed that on the Ed Sullivan Show you could prick your finger but not finger your prick. It was a world where some words were still shocking. Yes, we knew fuck. Of course we did. We said fuck all the time. Fuck you. Fuck your dog. Go take a flying fuck at a rolling donut. Fuck a duck. Hey, go fuck your sister. The rest of us did. But there, written in black letters 5 feet high, were the words, Fuck Johnson. Fuck the President of the United States. And Killer President. Someone had called the President of the United States of America a murderer. We couldn't believe it. When I came back from Holyoke, the other campus police car had arrived, and there were 6 campus cops, almost the whole damn force, I calculated, trying to put up a big rectangle of yellow canvas over the message. The crowd muttered, then started booing. The cops looked at them, annoyed. One shouted for them to break it up. Go on, they all had places to go. That might have been true, but apparently most of them liked it right there because the crowd didn't thin out much. The cop holding the far left end of the canvas drop cloth slipped in the snow and nearly fell. A few onlookers applauded. The cop who had slipped looked toward the sound with an expression of blackest hate momentarily congesting his face, and for me, that's when things really started to change, when the generations really started to gap. The cop who'd slipped turned away and began to struggle with the piece of canvas again. In the end, they settled for covering the first peace sign and the fuck of Fuck Johnson. And once the really bad word was hidden, the crowd did begin to break up. The snow was changing to sleet, and standing around had become uncomfortable. Better not let the cops see the back of your jacket, Skip said, and I looked around. He was standing beside me in a hooded sweatshirt, his hands plunged deep into the pouch in front. His breath came out of his mouth in frozen plumes. His eyes never left the campus cops and the part of the message which still remained. Johnson, killer president, out of Vietnam now. They'll think you did it. Or me. Smiling a little, Skip turned around. On the back of his sweatshirt, drawn in bright red ink, was another of those sparrow tracks. Jesus, I said. When did you do that? This morning, he said. I saw Nate's. He shrugged. It was just too cool not to copy. They won't think it was us. Not for a minute. No, I suppose not. The only question was why they weren't questioning Stoke already. Not that they'd have to ask many questions to get the truth out of him. But if Ebersole, the disciplinary officer, and Gerritsen, the dean of men, weren't talking to him, it was only because they hadn't yet talked to... Where's Deary? I asked. Do you know? The sleet was falling hard now, rattling through the trees and pinging every inch of exposed skin. The young and heroic Mr. Dearborn is out sanding sidewalks and paths with a dozen or so of his rotsy buddies, Skip said. We saw them from the lounge. They're driving around in a real army truck. Malenfant said their pricks are probably so hard they won't be able to sleep on their stomachs for a week. I thought that was pretty good for Ronnie. When Deary comes back... Yeah, when he comes back. Skip shrugged as if to say all that was beyond our control. Meanwhile, let's get out of this slop and play some cards. What do you say? I wanted to say a lot of stuff about a lot of things, but then again I didn't. We went back inside, and by mid-afternoon the game was in full swing once more. There were 5 four-handed sub-games going on. The room was blue with smoke, and someone had dragged in a phonograph so we could listen to the Beatles and the Stones. Someone else produced a scratched-up cameo 45 of 96 Tears, and that spun for at least an hour non-stop. Cry, cry, cry. The windows gave a good view on Bennett's Run and Bennett's Walk, and I kept looking out there, expecting to see David Dearborn and some of his khaki buddies staring at the north side of the dorm, perhaps discussing if they should go after Stoke Jones with their carbines or just chase him with their bayonets. Of course, they wouldn't do anything of the sort. They might chant, Kill Kong! Go U.S.! while drilling on the football field, but Stoke was a cripple. They would happily settle for seeing his commie-loving ass busted out of the University of Maine. I didn't want that to happen, but I didn't see any way it wouldn't. Stoke had had a sparrow track on the back of his coat since the beginning of school, long before the rest of us were hip to what it meant, and Deary knew it. Plus, Stoke would admit it. He'd deal with the dean and the disciplinary officer's questions the same way he dealt with his crutches, at a full-out plunge. And anyway, the whole thing began to seem distant, okay? The way classes did. The way Carol did, now that I understood she was really gone. The way the concept of being drafted and sent away to die in the jungle did. What seemed real and immediate was hunting out that bad bitch, or shooting the moon and hitting everyone else at your table with 26 points at a whack. What seemed real was hearts. But then something happened. Around 4 o'clock, the sleet changed to rain, and by 4:30, when it began to get dark, we could see that Bennett's Run was under 3 or 4 inches of water. Most of the walk looked like a canal. Below the water was a melting, slushy ice jello. The pace of the game slowed as we watched those unfortunates who were working the dish line cross from the dorms to the palace on the plains. Some of them, the wiser ones, cut across the slope of the hillside, making their way through the rapidly melting snow. The others came down the paths, slipping and sliding on their treacherous, icy surfaces. A thick mist had begun to rise from the wet ground, making it even harder for people to see where they were going. One guy from King met a girl from Franklin at the place where the paths converged. When they started up Bennett's walk together, the guy slipped and grabbed the girl. They almost went down together, but managed to keep their combined balance. We all applauded. At my table, we began a hold hand. Ronnie's weaselly little friend Nick dealt me an incredible 13 cards, maybe the best pat hand I'd ever gotten. It was a shoot-the-moon opportunity, if ever I had one. 6 high hearts and no really low ones, the king and queen of spades, plus court cards in the other 2 suits as well. I had the 7 of hearts, a borderline card, but you can catch people napping in a hold hand. No one expects you to shoot the moon in a situation where you can't improve your original draw. Lenny Doria played the douche to start us off. Ronnie immediately played void, ridding himself of the ace of spades. He thought that was great. So did I. My 2 court spades were now both winners. The queen was 13 points, but if I got all the hearts, I wouldn't eat those points. Ronnie, Nick, and Lenny would. I let Nick take the trick. We spilled 3 more tricks uneventfully. First Nick, and then Lenny, mine for diamonds. And then I took the 10 of hearts, mixed into a club trick. "Hearts have been broken, and Riley eats the first one," Ronnie bugled gleefully. "You're going down, country boy." "Maybe," I said. And maybe, I thought, Ronnie Malenfant would soon be smiling on the other side of his face. With a successful shoot, I could put the idiotic Nick Prouty over 100 and cost Ronnie a game he'd been on his way to winning. 3 tricks later, what I was doing became almost obvious. As I'd hoped, Ronnie's smirk became the expression I most enjoyed seeing on his face, the disgruntled pout. "You can't," he said. "I don't believe it. Not in a hold hand. You ain't got the fucking horses." Yet he knew it was possible. It was in his voice. "Well, let's see," I said, and played the ace of hearts. I was running in the open now, but why not? If the hearts were spread evenly, I could win the game right here. "Let's just see what we..." "Look," Skip called from the table nearest the window. His voice held disbelief and a kind of awe. "Jesus Christ! It's fucking Stokely." Play stopped. We all swiveled in our chairs to look out the window at the darkening, dripping world below us. The quartet of boys in the corner stood up to see. The old wrought iron lamps on Bennett's Walk cast weak electric beams through the ground mist, making me think of London and Tyne Street and Jack the Ripper. From its place on the hill, Holyoke Commons looked more like an ocean liner than ever. Its shape wavered as rain streamed down the lounge windows. "Fucking Rip-Rip, out in this crap." "I don't believe it," Ronnie breathed. Stoke came rapidly down the path which led from the north entrance of Chamberlain to the place where all the asphalt paths joined in the lowest part of Bennett's Run. He was wearing his old duffel coat, and it was clear he hadn't just come from the dorm. The coat was soaked through. Even through the streaming glass, we could see the peace sign on his back, as black as the words, which were now partly covered by a square of yellow canvas, if it was still up. His wild hair was soaked into submission. Stoke never looked toward his killer president graffiti, just thumped on toward Bennett's walk. He was going faster than I'd ever seen him move, paying no heed to the driving rain, the rising mist, or the slop under his crutches. Did he want to fall? Was he daring the slushy crap to take him down? I don't know. Maybe he was just too deep in his own thoughts to have any idea of how fast he was moving or how bad the conditions were. Either way, he wasn't going to get far if he didn't cool it. Ronnie began to giggle, and the sound spread the way a little flame spreads through dry tinder. I didn't want to join in, but was helpless to stop. So, I saw, was Skip. Partly because giggling is contagious, but also because it really was funny. I know how unkind that sounds, of course I do, but I've come too far not to tell the truth about that day. And this day, almost half a lifetime later, because it still seems funny to me. I still smile when I think back to how he looked, a frantic clockwork toy in a duffel coat, thudding along through the pouring rain, his crutches splashing up water as he went. You knew what was going to happen. You just knew it. And that was the funniest part of all, the question of just how far he could make it before the inevitable wipeout. Lenny was roaring with one hand clutched to his face, staring out between his splayed fingers, his eyes streaming. Hugh Brennan was holding his not inconsiderable gut and braying like a donkey stuck in a mud hole. Mark St. Pierre was howling uncontrollably and saying he was going to piss himself. He'd drunk too many cokes and he was going to spray his fucking jeans. I was laughing so hard I couldn't hold my cards. The nerves in my right hand went dead, my fingers relaxed, and those last few winning tricks fluttered into my lap. My head was pounding and my sinuses were full. Stoke made the bottom of the dip where the walk started. There he paused and for some reason did a crazed 360 spin, seeming to balance on one crutch. The other crutch he held out like a machine gun, as if in his mind he was spraying the whole campus. Kill Kong, slaughter proctors, bayonet those upperclassmen. And the Olympic judges give him all tens, Tony DeLuca called in a perfect sports announcer's voice. It was the final touch. The place turned into bedlam on the spot. Cards flew everywhere. Ashtrays spilled, and one of the glass ones, most were just those little aluminum table-talk pie dishes, broke. Someone fell out of his chair and began to roll around, bellowing and kicking his legs. Man, we just couldn't stop laughing. That's it, Mark was howling. I just drowned my jockeys. I couldn't help it. Behind him, Nick Prouty was crawling toward the window on his knees with tears coursing down his burning face and his hands held out, the wordless begging gesture of a man who wants to say, make it stop before I burst a fucking blood vessel in the middle of my brain and die right here. Skip got up, overturning his chair. I got up. Laughing our brains out, we groped for one another and staggered toward the window with our arms slung around each other's back. Below, unaware that he was being watched and laughed at by 24 or so freaked-out card players, Stoke Jones was still, amazingly, on his feet. "Go rip-rip," Ronnie began to chant. "Go rip-rip," Nick joined in. He had reached the window and was leaning his forehead against it, still laughing. "Go rip-rip. Go, baby. Go. On, rip-rip. Mush those huskies. Work those crutches, big boy. Go, you fucking rip-rip." It was like the last play of a close football game, except everyone was chanting, "Go rip-rip," instead of "hold that line" or "block that kick." Almost everyone. I wasn't chanting, and I don't think Skip was either, but we were laughing. We were laughing just as hard as the rest. Suddenly I thought of the night Carol and I had sat on the milk boxes beside Holyoke, the night she had shown me the snapshot of herself and her childhood friends, and then told me the story of what those other boys had done to her, what they had done with a baseball bat. At first, they were joking, I think, Carol had said. And had they been laughing? Probably, yeah. Because that's what you did when you were joking around, having a good time. You laughed. Stokes stood where he was for a moment, hanging from his crutches with his head down. And then he attacked the hill like the Marines going ashore at Tarawa. He went tearing up Bennett's walk, spraying water everywhere with his flying crutches. It was like watching a duck with rabies. The chant became deafening. Go rip rip, go rip rip, go rip rip. At first they were joking, she had said, as we sat there on the milk boxes smoking our cigarettes. By then she was crying, her tears silver in the white light from the dining hall above us. At first they were joking, and then they weren't. That thought ended the joke of Stoke for me. I swear to you that it did. And still, I couldn't stop laughing. Stokely made it about a third of the way up the hill toward Holyoke, almost back to the visible bricks, before the slippery slop finally got him. He planted his crutches far in advance of his body, too far for even dry conditions, and when he swung forward, both sticks flew out from under him. His legs flipped up like the legs of a gymnast doing some fabulous trick on the balance beam, and he went down on his back with a tremendous splash. We could hear it even from the third-floor lounge. It was the final perfect touch. The lounge looked like a lunatic asylum where the inmates had all come down with food poisoning at the same time. We staggered aimlessly about, laughing and clutching at our throats, our eyes spouting tears. I was hanging on to Skip because my legs would no longer support me. My knees felt like noodles. I was laughing harder than I ever had in my life, harder than I ever have since, I think, and still I kept thinking about Carol sitting there on the milk box beside me, legs crossed, cigarette in one hand, snapshot in the other, Carol saying, "Harry Doolin hit me. Willie and the other one held me, so I couldn't run away." At first they were joking, I think, and then they weren't. Out on Bennett's walk, Stoke tried to sit up. He got his upper body partway out of the water, and then lay back, full length, as if that icy, slushy water were a bed. He lifted both arms skyward in a gesture which was almost invocatory, then let them fall again. It was every surrender ever given summed up in three motions, the lying back, the lifting of the arms, the double splash as they fell back wide to either side. It was the ultimate fuck it, do what you want, I quit. "Come on," Skip said. He was still laughing, but he was also completely serious. I could hear the seriousness in his laughing voice and could see it in his hysterically contorted face. I was glad it was there. God, I was glad. "Come on, before the stupid motherfuck drowns." Skip and I crammed through the doorway of the lounge, shoulder to shoulder, and sprinted down the third-floor hall, bouncing off each other like pinballs, reeling, almost as out of control as Stoke had been on the path. Most of the others followed us. The only one I know for sure who didn't was Mark. He went down to his room to change out of his soaked jeans. We met Nate on the second-floor landing. Damn near ran him down. He was standing there with an armload of books in a plastic sack, looking at us with some alarm. "Good grief," he said. That was Nate at his strongest, good grief. "What's wrong with you?" "Come on," Skip said. His throat was so choked, the words came out in a growl. If I hadn't been with him earlier, I'd have thought he'd just finished a fit of weeping. "It's not us. It's fucking Jones. He fell down. He needs..." Skip broke off his laughter, great big belly gusts of it, overtook him and shook him once again. He fell back against the wall, rolling his eyes in a kind of hilarious exhaustion. He shook his head as if to deny it, but of course you can't deny laughter. When it comes, it plops down in your favorite chair and stays as long as it wants. Above us, the stairs began to thunder with descending third-floor card players. "He needs help," Skip finished, wiping his eyes. Nate looked at me in growing bewilderment. "If he needs help, why are you guys laughing?" I couldn't explain it to him. Hell, I couldn't explain it to myself. I grabbed Skip by the arm and yanked. We started down the steps to the first floor. Nate followed us. So did the rest. The first thing I saw when we banged out through the north door was that rectangle of yellow canvas. It was lying on the ground, full of water and floating lumps of slush. Then the water on the path started pouring in through my sneakers, and I forgot all about sightseeing. It was freezing. The rain drove down on my exposed skin in needles that were not quite ice. In Bennett's Run, the water was ankle deep, and my feet went from cold to numb. Skip slipped, and I grabbed his arm. Nate steadied us both from behind and kept us from tumbling over backward. Ahead of us, I could hear a nasty sound that was half coughing and half choking. Stoke lay in the water like a sodden log, his duffel coat floating around his body and those masses of black hair floating around his face. The cough was deep and bronchial. Fine droplets sprayed from his lips with each gagging, choking outburst. One of his crutches lay next to him, caught between his arm and his side. The other was floating away in the direction of Bennett Hall. Water slopped over Stokes' pale face. His coughing took on a strangled, gargling quality. His eyes stared straight up into the rain and fog. He gave no sign that he heard us coming, but when I knelt on one side of him and Skip on the other, he tried to beat us away with his hands. Water ran into his mouth, and he began to thrash. He was drowning in front of us. I no longer felt like laughing, but I might still have been doing it. At first they were joking, Carol said. At first they were joking. Put on the radio, Pete. I like the oldies. Pick him up, Skip said, and grabbed one of Stokes' shoulders. Stokes slapped at him weakly with one wax dummy hand. Skip ignored this, might not have even felt it. Hurry up, for Christ's sake. I grabbed Stokes' other shoulder. He splashed water in my face as though we were fucking around in someone's backyard pool. I had thought he'd be as cold as I was, but there was a sickish heat coming off his skin. I looked across his waterlogged body to Skip. Skip nodded back at me. Ready, set, now. We heaved. Stoke came partly out of the water, from the waist up, but that was all. I was astounded by the weight of him. His shirt had come untucked from his pants and floated around his middle like a ballerina's tutu. Below it, I could see his white skin and the black bullet hole of his navel. There were scars there, too, healed scars, wavering every which way like snarls of knotted string. Help out, Nady, Skip grunted. Prop him up, for fuck's sake. Nate dropped to his knees, splashing all three of us, and grabbed Stoke in a kind of backwards hug. We struggled to get him all the way up and out of the soup, but the slush on the bricks kept us off balance, made it impossible for us to work together. And Stoke, although still coughing and half drowned, was also working against us, struggling as best he could to be free of us. Stoke wanted to go back in the water. The others arrived, Ronnie in the lead. Fucking Rip-Rip, he breathed. He was still giggling, but he looked slightly awestruck. You screwed up big this time, Rip. No doubt. Don't just stand there, you numb tool, Skip cried. Help us. Ronnie paused a moment longer, not angry, just assessing how this might best be done, then turned to see who else was there. He slipped on the slush, and Tony DeLuca, also still giggling, grabbed him and steadied him. They were crowded together on the drowned walk, all my card-playing buddies from the third-floor lounge, and most of them still couldn't stop laughing. They looked like something, but I didn't know what. I might never have known if not for Carol's Christmas present. But, of course, that came later. You, Tony, Ronnie said. Brad, Lenny, Barry, let's get his legs. What about me, Ronnie? Nick asked. What about me? You're too small to help lift him, Ronnie said, but it might cheer him up to get his dick sucked. Nick stood back. Ronnie, Tony, Brad, Lenny, and Barry Margot slipped past us on either side. Ronnie and Tony got stoked by the calves. Christ Jesus! Tony cried, disgusted and still half laughing. Nothing to him. Legs like on a scarecrow. Legs like on a scarecrow. Legs like on a scarecrow, Ronnie cried, viciously mimicking. Pick him the fuck up, you wop Nimrod. This isn't art appreciation. Lenny and Barry, get under his deprived ass when they do. Then you come up. When the rest of you guys lift him, Lenny finished. Got it. And don't call my paisan a wop. Leave me alone, Stoke coughed. Stop it. Get away from me, fucking losers! The coughing overtook him again. He began to make gruesome retching sounds. In the lamplight, his lips looked gray and slick. Look who's talking about being a loser, Ronnie said. Fucking half-drowned, crippled-up Jerry's kid homo. He looked at Skip, water running out of his wavy hair and over his pimply face. Count us off, Kirk. 1, 2, 3, now. We lifted. Stoke Jones came out of the water like a salvaged ship. We staggered back and forth with him. One of his arms flopped in front of me. It hung there for a moment, and then the hand attached to the end of it arced up and slapped me hard across the face. Whacko! I started laughing again. Put me down! Motherfuckers, put me down! We staggered, dancing on the slush, water pouring off him, water pouring off us. Eccles! Ronnie bawled. Marchant! Brennan! Jesus Christ! Little help here, you fucking brain-dead ringmeats! What do you say? Randy and Billy splashed forward. Others, three or four drawn by the shouts and splashing, most still from the third-floor Hearts group, took hold of Stoke as well. We turned him awkwardly, probably looking like the world's most spastic cheerleading squad, for some reason out practicing in the downpour. Stoke had quit struggling. He lay in our grip, arms hanging out to either side, palms up and filling with little cups of rain. Diminishing waterfalls ran out of his sodden jacket and from the seat of his pants. He picked me up and carried me, Carol had said, talking about the boy with the crew cut, the boy who had been her first love. All the way up Broad Street, on one of the hottest days of the year, he carried me in his arms. I couldn't get her voice out of my head. In a way, I never have. The dorm? Ronnie asked Skip. We taking him into the dorm? Jeepers, no, Nate said. The infirmary. Since we'd managed to get him out of the water, that was the hardest part, and it was behind us. The infirmary made sense. It was a small brick building just beyond Bennett Hall, no more than 300 or 400 yards away. Once we got off the path and onto the road, the footing would be good. So we carried him to the infirmary, bore him up at shoulder height like a slain hero being ceremonially removed from the field of battle. Some of us were still laughing in little snorts and giggles. I was one of them. Once I saw Nate looking at me as if I were a thing almost below contempt, and I tried to stop the sounds that were coming out of me. I'd do okay for a little while, then I'd think of him spinning on the pivot of his crutch. The Olympic judges give him all tens, and I'd start in again. Stoke only spoke once as we carried him up the walk to the infirmary door. Let me die, he said. For once in your stupid, greedy, me lives, do something worthwhile. Put me down and let me die. The waiting room was empty, the television in the corner showing an old episode of Bonanza to no one at all. In those days, they hadn't really found the handle on color TV yet, and Pa Cartwright's face was the color of a fresh avocado. We must have sounded like a herd of hippopotami just out of the watering hole, and the duty nurse came on the run. Following her was a candy striper, probably a work-study kid like me, and a little guy in a white coat. He had a stethoscope hung around his neck and a cigarette poked in the corner of his mouth. In Atlantis, even the doctors smoked. "What's the trouble with him?" the doc asked Ronnie, either because Ronnie had an in-charge look or because he was the closest at hand. Took a header in Bennett's run while he was on his way to Holyoke, Ronnie said. Damn near drowned himself. He paused, then added, he's a cripple. As if to underline this point, Billy Marchant waved one of Stoke's crutches. Apparently no one had bothered to salvage the other one. Put that thing down. You want to fucking bonk my brains out? Nick Prouty asked, waspishly, ducking. What brains? Brad responded, and we all laughed so hard we nearly dropped Stoke. Suck me sideways, ass breath, Nick said, but he was laughing too. The doctor was frowning. Bring him in here and save that language for your bull sessions. Stoke began coughing again, a deep ratcheting sound. You expected to see blood and filaments of tissue come popping out of his mouth, that cough was so heavy. We carried Stoke down the infirmary hallway in a conga line, but we couldn't get him through the door that way. Let me, Skip said.
You'll drop him, Nate said.
No, Skip said, I won't. Just let me get a good hold. He stepped up beside Stoke, then nodded first to me on his right, then to Ronnie on his left.
Lower him down, Ronnie said.
We did. Skip grunted once as he took Stoke's weight, and I saw the veins pop out in his neck. Then we stood back, and Skip carried Stoke into the room and laid him on the exam table. The thin sheet of paper covering the leather was immediately soaked. Skip stepped back. Stoke was staring up at him, his face dead pale except for two red patches high on his cheekbones. Red as rouge, those patches were. Water ran out of his hair in rivulets.
Sorry, man, Skip said.
Stoke turned his head away and closed his eyes.
Out, the doctor told Skip.
He had ditched the cigarette somewhere. He looked around at us, a gaggle of perhaps a dozen boys, most still grinning, all dripping on the hall's tile floor. Does anyone know the nature of his disability? It can make a difference in how we treat him. I thought of the scars I'd seen, those tangles of knotted string, but said nothing. I didn't really know anything, and now that the uncontrollable urge to laugh had passed, I felt too ashamed of myself to speak up.
It's just one of those cripple things, isn't it? Ronnie asked.
Actually faced with an adult, he had lost his shrill cockiness. He sounded unsure, perhaps even uneasy.
Muscular palsy or cerebral dystrophy or...
You clown, Lenny said. It's muscular dystrophy and cerebral...
He was in a car accident, Nate said.
We all looked around at him. Nate still looked neat and totally put together in spite of the soaking he'd taken. This afternoon he was wearing a Fort Kent High School ski hat. The Maine football team had finally scored a touchdown and freed Nate from his beanie. Go you Black Bears. 4 years ago, his father, mother, and older sister were killed. He was the only family survivor. There was silence. I looked between Skip and Tony's shoulders and into the examination room. Stoke still lay streaming on the table. His head turned to the side, his eyes shut. The nurse was taking his blood pressure. His pants clung to his legs, and I thought of the 4th of July parade they used to have back home in Gates Falls when I was just a little kid. Uncle Sam would come striding along between the school band and the Anna Temple Shrine guys on their midget motorcycles, looking at least 10 feet tall in his starry blue hat. But when the wind blew his pants against his legs, you could see the trick. That's what Stoke Jones's legs looked like inside his wet pants. A trick, a bad joke, sawed-off stilts with sneakers poked onto the ends of them.
How do you know that? Skip asked. Did he tell you, Nate?
No. Nate looked ashamed. He told Harry Swidrowski after a committee of resistance meeting. We were in the bear's den. Harry asked him right out what happened to his legs, and Stoke told him. I thought I understood the look on Nate's face. After the meeting, he had said. After. Nate didn't know what had been said at the meeting because Nate hadn't been there. Nate wasn't a member of the Committee of Resistance. Nate was strictly a sidelines boy. He might agree with the CR's goals and tactics, but he had his mother to think about, and his future as a dentist. Spinal injury? The doctor asked, brisker than ever.
I think so, yeah, Nate said.
All right. Doc began making shooing gestures with his hands, as if we were a flock of geese. Go on back to your dorms. We'll take good care of him. We began to back up toward the reception area. Why were you boys laughing when you brought him in? The nurse asked suddenly. She stood by the doctor with the blood pressure cuff in her hands. Why are you grinning now? She sounded angry. Hell, she sounded furious. What was so funny about this boy's misfortune that it made you laugh? I didn't think anyone would answer. We'd just stand there and look down at our shuffling feet, realizing that we were still a lot closer to the fourth grade than we had perhaps thought. But someone did answer. Skip answered. He even managed to look at her as he did. His misfortune, ma'am, he said. That's what it was, you're right. It was his misfortune that was funny.
How terrible, she said. There were tears of rage standing in the corners of her eyes. How terrible you are.
Yes, ma'am, Skip said. I guess you're right about that, too.
He turned away from her. We followed him back to the reception area in a wet and beaten little group. I can't say that being called terrible was the low point of my college career. If you can remember much of the 60s, you weren't there, the hippie known as Wavy Gravy once said. But it may have been. The waiting room was still empty. Little Joe Cartwright was on the tube now, and just as green as his dad. Pancreatic cancer was what got Michael Landon, too. He and my mother had that in common. Skip stopped. Ronnie, head down, pushed past him toward the door, followed by Nick, Billy, Lenny, and the rest. Hold it, Skip said, and they turned. I want to talk to you guys about something. We gathered around him. Skip glanced once toward the door leading back to the exam area, verified that we were alone, then began to talk. 10 minutes later, Skip and I walked back to the dorm by ourselves. The others had gone ahead. Nate hung with us for a little bit, then must have picked up a vibe that I wanted to talk privately to Skip. Nate was always good at picking up the vibe. I bet he's a good dentist, that the children in particular like him. I'm done playing hearts, I said. Skip said nothing. I don't know if it's too late to pull up my grades enough to keep my scholarship or not, but I'm going to try, and I don't care much one way or the other. The fucking scholarship's not the point. No, they're the point, right? Ronnie and the rest of them. I think they're only part of it. It was so cold out there as that day turned to dark, cold and damp and evil. It seemed that it would never be summer again. Man, I miss Carol. Why'd she have to go? I don't know. When he fell over, it sounded like a nut house up there, I said. Not a college dorm, a fucking nut house. You laughed too, Pete. So did I. I know, I said. I might not have if I'd been alone, and Skip and I might not have if it had just been the two of us. But how could you tell? You were stuck with the way things played out. I kept thinking of Carol and those boys with their baseball bat. And I thought of the way Nate had looked at me, as if I were a thing below contempt. I know. We walked in silence for a while. I can live with laughing at him, I guess, I said, but I don't want to wake up 40 with my kids asking me what college was like and not being able to remember anything but Ronnie Malenfant telling Polish jokes and that poor fucked-up asshole McClendon trying to kill himself with baby aspirin. I thought about Stoke Jones twirling on his crutch and felt like laughing. Thought of him lying beached on the exam table in the infirmary and felt like crying. And you know what? It was, as far as I could tell, exactly the same feeling. I just feel bad about it. I feel like shit.
So do I, Skip said. The rain poured down around us, soaking and cold. The lights of Chamberlain Hall were bright, but not particularly comforting. I could see the yellow canvas the cops had put up lying on the grass, and above it, the dim shapes of the spray-painted letters. They were running in the rain. By the following day, they would be all but unreadable.
When I was a little kid, I always pretended I was the hero, Skip said.
Fuck yeah, me too. What little kid ever pretended to be part of the lynch mob?
Skip looked down at his soaked shoes, then up at me.
Could I study with you for the next couple of weeks?
Anytime you want.
You really don't mind?
Why would I fucking mind? I made myself sound irritated because I didn't want him to hear how relieved I was, how almost thrilled I was. Because it might work.
I paused, then said, "This other, do you think we can pull it off?"
"I don't know. Maybe."
We had almost reached the north entrance, and I pointed to the running letters just before we went in. Maybe Dean Gerritsen and that guy Ebersole will let the whole thing drop. The paint Stoke used didn't even get a chance to set. It'll be gone by morning.
Skip shook his head. They won't let it drop.
Why not? How can you be so sure?
Because Deary won't let them.
And, of course, He was right. For the first time in weeks, the third-floor lounge was empty for a while as drenched card players dried themselves off and put on fresh clothes. Many of them also took care of some stuff Skip Kirk had suggested in the infirmary waiting room. When Nate and Skip and I came back from dinner, however, it was business as usual in the lounge. Three tables were up and going.
"Hey, Riley," Ronnie said. "Twiller here says he's got a study date. If you want to see it, I'll teach you how to play the game."
"Not tonight," I said. "Got studying to do myself."
"Yeah," Randy Eccles said. "The art of self-abuse."
"That's right, honey. A couple more weeks of hard work and I'll be able to switch hands without missing a stroke, just like you." As I started away, Ronnie said, "I had you stop, Riley." I turned around. Ronnie was leaning back in his chair, smiling that unpleasant smile of his. For a short period of time, out there in the rain, I had glimpsed a different Ronnie, but that young man had gone back into hiding.
"No," I said, "you didn't. It was a done deal."
"No one shoots the moon on a hold hand," Ronnie said, leaning back farther than ever. He scratched one cheek, busting the heads off a couple of pimples. They oozed tendrils of yellow-white cream.
"Not at my table, they don't. I had you stopped in clubs."
"You were void in clubs, unless you reneged on the first trick. You played the ace of spades when Lenny played the douche, and in hearts, I had the whole court." Ronnie's smile faltered for just a moment, then came back strong. He waved a hand at the floor, from which all the spilled cards had been picked up. The bloody remains of the overturned ashtrays still remained. Most of us had been raised in homes where moms cleaned up such messes.
"All the high hearts, huh? Too bad we can't check and see."
"Yeah, too bad." I started away again.
"You're going to fall behind on match points," he called after me. "You know that, don't you?"
"You can have mine, Ronnie. I don't want them anymore." I never played another hand of hearts in college. Many years later, I taught my kids the game, and they took to it like ducks to water. We have a tournament at the summer cottage every August. There are no match points, but there's a trophy from Atlantic Awards, a loving cup. I won it one year and kept it on my desk where I could see it. I shot the moon twice in the championship round, but neither was a hold hand. Like my old school buddy Ronnie Malenfant once said, no one shoots the moon on a hold hand. You might as well expect Atlantis to rise from the ocean, palm trees waving. At 8 o'clock that night, Skip Kirk was at my desk and deep in his anthro text. His hands were plunged into his hair, as if he had a bad headache. Nate was at his desk, doing a botany paper. I was sprawled on my bed, struggling with my old friend, geology. On the stereo, Bob Dylan sang, "She was the funniest woman I ever seen, the great-grandmother of Mr. Clean." There was a hard double rap on the door, pow, pow. "Floor meeting," Deary called. "Floor meeting in the rec at 9 o'clock. Attendance mandatory." "Oh, Christ," I said. "Burn the secret papers and eat the radio." Nate turned down Dylan, and we heard Deary going on up the hall, rapping that pow-pow on every door and yelling about the floor meeting in the rec. Most of the rooms he was hailing were probably empty, but no problem. He'd find the occupants down in the lounge, chasing the bitch. Skip was looking at me. "Told you," he said. Each dorm in our complex had been built at the same time, and each had a big common area in the basement, as well as the lounges in the center of each floor. There was a TV alcove, which filled up mostly for weekend sports events, and a vampire soap opera called Dark Shadows during the week. A canteen corner with half a dozen vending machines, a ping-pong table, and a number of chess and checkerboards.
There was also a meeting area with a podium standing before several rows of folding wooden chairs. We'd had a floor meeting there at the beginning of the year, at which Deary had explained the dorm rules and the dire consequences of unsatisfactory room inspections. I'd have to say that room inspections were Deary's big thing. That and ROTC, of course. He stood behind the little wooden podium upon which he had laid a thin file folder. I suppose it contained his notes. He was still dressed in his damp and muddy rotsy fatigues. He looked exhausted from his day of shoveling and sanding, but he also looked excited. Turned on is how we'd put it a year or two later. Deary had been on his own at the first floor meeting. This time, he had backup. Sitting against the green cinder block wall, hands folded in his lap and knees primly together, was Sven Gerritsen, the Dean of Men. He said almost nothing during that meeting and looked benign even when the air grew stormy. Standing beside Deary, wearing a black topcoat over a charcoal gray suit and looking very can-do, was Ebersole, the disciplinary officer. After we had settled in the chairs and those of us who smoked had lit up, Deary looked first over his shoulder at Gerritsen, then at Ebersole. Ebersole gave him a little smile. "Go ahead, David, please. They're your boys." I felt a rankle of irritation. I might be a lot of things, including a creep who laughed at cripples when they fell down in the pouring rain, but I was not Deary Dearborn's boy. Deary gripped the podium and looked at us solemnly, perhaps thinking, far back in the part of his mind reserved expressly for dreamy dreams, that a day would come when he would address his staff officers this way, setting some great tide of Hanoi-bound troops in motion. "Jones is missing," he said finally. It came out sounding portentous and corny, like a line in a Charles Bronson movie. "He's in the infirmary," I said, and enjoyed the surprise on Deary's face. Ebersole looked surprised, too. Gerritsen just went on gazing benignly into the middle distance, like a man on a three-pipe high. "What happened to him?" Deary asked. This wasn't in the script, either the one he had worked out or the one he and Ebersole had prepared together, and Deary began to frown. He was also gripping the podium more tightly, as if afraid it might fly away. "Far down, go boom," Ronnie said, and puffed up when the people around him laughed. "Also, I think he's got pneumonia or double bronchitis or something like that." He caught Skip's eye, and I thought Skip nodded slightly. This was Skip's show, not Deary's, but if we were lucky, if Stoke was lucky, the three at the front of the room would never know it. "Tell me this from the beginning," Deary said. The frown was becoming a glower. It was the way he'd looked after discovering his door had been shaving creamed. Skip told Deary and Deary's new friends how we'd seen Stoke heading toward the palace on the plains from the third-floor lounge windows, how he'd fallen into the water, how we'd rescued him and taken him to the infirmary, how the doctor had said Stoke was one sick puppy. The doc hadn't said any such thing, but he didn't need to. Those of us who had touched Stoke's skin knew that he was running a fever, and all of us had heard that horrible deep cough. Skip said nothing about how fast Stoke had been moving, as if he wanted to kill the whole world and then die himself. And he said nothing about how we'd laughed, Mark St. Pierre so hard he'd wet his pants. When Skip finished, Deary glanced uncertainly at Ebersole. Ebersole looked back blandly. Behind them, Dean Gerritsen continued to smile his little Buddha smile. The implication was clear. It was Deary's show. He'd better have a show to put on. Deary took a deep breath and looked back at us. "We believe Stokely Jones was responsible for the act of vandalism and public obscenity, which was perpetrated on the north end of Chamberlain Hall at a time we don't know when this morning." I'm telling you exactly what he said, not making a single word of it up, other than it became necessary to destroy the village in order to save it. That was perhaps the most sublime example of honcho speak I ever heard in my life. I believe Deary expected us to ooh and ah like the extras in a Perry Mason courtroom finale, where the revelations start coming thick and fast. Instead, we were silent. Skip watched closely, and when he saw Deary draw in another deep breath for the next pronouncement, he said, What makes you think it was him, dearie? Although I'm not completely sure, I never asked him. I believe Skip used the nickname purposely to throw Deary even further off his stride. In any case, it worked. Deary started to go off, looked at Ebersole, and recalculated his options. A red line was rising out of his collar. I watched it climb, fascinated. It was a little like watching a Disney cartoon where Donald Duck is trying to control his temper. You know he can't possibly do it. The suspense comes from not knowing how long he can maintain even a semblance of reason. "I think you know the answer to that, Skip," Deary finally said. "Stokely Jones wears a coat with a very particular symbol on the back." He picked up the folder he had carried in, removed a sheet of paper, looked at it, then turned it around so we can look at it too. None of us was very surprised by what was there. This symbol. It was invented by the Communist Party shortly after the end of the Second World War. It means victory through infiltration and is commonly called the Broken Cross by subversives. It has also become very popular with such inner-city radical groups as the Black Muslims and the Black Panthers. Since this symbol was visible on Stoke Jones's coat long before it appeared on the side of our dorm, I hardly think it takes a rocket scientist to... "David, that is such bullshit!" Nate said, standing up. He was pale and trembling, but with anger rather than fear. Had I ever heard him say the word bullshit in public before? I don't think so. Gerritsen smiled his benign smile at my roommate. Ebersole raised his eyebrows, expressing polite interest. Deary looked stunned. I suppose the last person he expected trouble from was Nate Hoppenstand. "That symbol is based on British semaphore and stands for nuclear disarmament. It was invented by a famous British philosopher. I think he might even be a knight. To say the Russians made it up, goodness sake, is that what they teach you in ROTC? Bullshit like that?" Nate was staring at Deary angrily, his hands planted on his hips. Deary gaped at him, now completely knocked off his stride. Yes, they had taught him that in ROTC, and he had swallowed it, hook, line, and sinker. It made you wonder what else the ROTC kids were swallowing. "I'm sure these facts about the Broken Cross are very interesting," Ebersole cut in smoothly, "and it's certainly information worth having. If it's true, of course." "It's true," Skip said. "Bert Russell, not Joe Stalin. British kids were wearing it 5 years ago when they marched to protest the U.S. nuclear subs operating out of ports in the British Isles." "Fucking A!" Ronnie cried and pumped his fist in the air. A year or so later, the Panthers, who never had much use for Bertrand Russell's peace signs, so far as I know, were doing that same thing at their rallies. And, of course, 20 years or so further on down the line, all of us cleaned-up 60s babies were doing it at rock concerts. "Bruce! Bruce!"
"Go, baby," Hugh Brennan chimed in, laughing. "Go, Skip! Go, Big Nate!"
"Watch your language while the dean's here," Deary shouted at Ronnie. Ebersole ignored the profanity and the crosstalk from the peanut gallery. He kept his interested, skeptical gaze trained on my roommate and on Skip.
"Even if all that's true," he said, "we still have a problem, don't we?" "I think so. We have an act of vandalism and public obscenity. This comes at a time when the taxpaying public is looking at university youth with an ever more critical eye. And this institution depends upon the taxpaying public, gentlemen. I think it behooves us all..."
"To think about this!" Deary suddenly shouted. His cheeks were now almost purple. His forehead swarmed with weird red spots like brands, and right between his eyes, a big vein was pulsing rapidly. Before Deary could say more, and he clearly had a lot to say, Ebersole put a hand out to his chest, shushing him. Deary seemed to deflate. He'd had his chance and fluffed it. Later, he'd perhaps tell himself it was because he was tired, while we'd spent the day in the nice warm lounge playing cards and shooting holes in our future. Deary had been outside shoveling snow and sanding walks so brittle old psychology professors wouldn't fall down and break their hips. He was tired, a little slow on the draw, and in any case, that prick Ebersole hadn't given him a fair chance to prove himself. all of which probably didn't help much with what was happening right then. He had been set aside. The grown-up was back in charge. Papa would fix.
I think it behooves us all to identify the fellow who did this and see he's punished with some severity, Ebersole continued.
Mostly it was Nate he was looking at. Amazing as it seemed to me at the time, he had identified Nate Hoppenstand as the center of the resistance he felt in the room. Nate, God bless his molars and wisdom teeth, was more than up to the likes of Ebersole. He remained standing with his hands on his hips, and his eyes never wavered, let alone dropped from Ebersole's.
How do you propose doing that? Nate asked.
What is your name, young man? Please.
Nathan Hoppenstand.
Well, Nathan, I think the perpetrator has already been singled out, don't you?
Ebersole spoke in a patient, teacherly way. Or rather, singled himself out.
I'm told this unfortunate fellow, Stokely Jones, has been a walking billboard for the Broken Cross symbol since...
Quit calling it that, Skip said, and I jumped a little at the raw anger in his voice.
It's not a broken anything. It's a damn peace sign.
What is your name, sir?
Stanley Kirk. Skip to my friends. You can call me Stanley. There was a tense little titter at this, which Ebersole seemed not to hear.
Well, Mr. Kirk, your semantic quibble is noted, but it doesn't change the fact that Stokely Jones, and Stokely Jones alone, has been displaying that particular symbol all over campus since the first day of the semester. Mr. Dearborn tells me.
Nate said, Mr. Dearborn doesn't even know what the peace sign is or where it came from, so I think you'd be sort of unwise to trust what he tells you very far. It just so happens I've got the peace sign on the back of my own jacket, Mr. Ebersole, so how do you know I wasn't the one with the spray paint?
Ebersole's mouth dropped open. Not much, but enough to spoil his sympathetic smile and magazine ad good looks. And Dean Gerritsen frowned, as if presented with some concept he couldn't understand. One very rarely sees a good politician or college administrator caught completely by surprise. They are moments to treasure. I treasured that one then, and find I still do today.
That's a lie, Deary said. He sounded more wounded than angry. Why would you lie that way, Nate? You're the last person on three I'd expect to.
It's not a lie, Nate said. Go on up to my room and pull the peacoat out of my closet if you don't believe me. Check.
Yeah, and check mine while you're at it, I said, standing up next to Nate. My old high school jacket. You can't miss it. It's the one with the peace sign on the back.
Ebersole studied us through slightly narrowed eyes. Then he asked,
Exactly when did you put this so-called peace sign on the backs of your jackets, young fellows?
This time, Nate didn't lie. I knew him well enough by then to know it must have hurt, but he did it like a champ.
September.
That was it for Deary. He went nuclear, is how my own kids might express it, only that wouldn't be accurate. Deary went Donald Duck. He didn't quite jump up and down, flapping his arms and going quack, 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 like Donald does when he's mad. But he did give a howl of outrage and smacked his mottled forehead with the heels of his palms.
Ebersole stilled him again, this time by gripping his arm.
Who are you? Ebersole asked me, more curt than courteous by now.
Pete Riley. I put a peace sign on the back of my jacket because I like the look of Stokes. Also to show I've got some big questions about what we're doing over there in Vietnam.
Deary pulled away from Ebersole. His chin was thrust out, his lips pulled back enough to show a complete set of teeth.
Helping our allies is what we're doing, you doofus, he shouted. If you're too stupid to see that on your own, I suggest you take Colonel Anderson's intro military history class. Or maybe you're just another chicken guts who won't...
Hush, Mr. Dearborn, Dean Gerritsen said. His quiet was somehow louder than Deary's shouting. This is not the place for a foreign policy debate, nor is it the time for personal aspersions. Quite the contrary.
Deary dropped his burning face, studied the floor, and began to gnaw at his own lips.
And when, Mr. Riley, did you put the peace sign symbol on your jacket? Ebersole asked.
His voice remained courteous, but there was an ugly look in his eyes. He knew by then, I think, that Stoke was going to squiggle away, and Ebersole was very unhappy about that. Deary was small change next to this guy, who was in 1966 a new type on the college campuses of America. Times call the men, Lao Tzu said, and the late 60s called Charles Ebersole. He wasn't an educator. He was an enforcer, minoring in public relations.
Don't lie to me, his eyes said. Don't lie to me, Riley, because if you do and I find out, I'll turn you into salad.
But what the hell, I'd probably be gone come January 15th anyway. By Christmas of 1967, I might be in Phu Bai, keeping the place warm for Deary.
October, I said. Put it on my jacket, right around Columbus Day.
I've got it on my jacket and some sweatshirts, Skip said. All that stuff's in my room. I'll show it to you if you want.
Deary, still looking down at the floor and red to the roots of his hair, was shaking his head monotonously back and forth.
I've got it on a couple of my sweatshirts, too, Ronnie said. I'm no peacenik, but it's a cool sign. I like it.
Tony DeLuca said he also had one on the back of a sweatshirt. Lenny Doria told Ebersole and Gerritsen he had doodled it on the end papers of several different textbooks. It was on the front of his general assignments notebook as well. He'd show them if they wanted to see. Billy Marchant had it on his jacket. Brad Witherspoon had inked it on his freshman beanie. The beanie was in the back of his closet somewhere, probably beneath the underwear he'd forgotten to take home for his mom to wash. Nick Prouty said he'd drawn peace signs on his favorite record albums, MC5's Kick Out the Jams and Wayne Fontana and the Mind Benders.
You ain't got any mind to bend, Dinkleballs, Ronnie muttered, and there was laughter from behind cupped hands. Several others reported having the peace sign on books or items of clothing. All claimed to have done this long before the discovery of the graffiti on the north end of Chamberlain Hall. In a final surreal touch, Hugh stood up, stepped into the aisle, and hiked the legs of his jeans so we could see the yellowing athletic socks climbing his hairy shins. A peace sign had been drawn on both, with the laundry marker Mrs. Brennan had sent to school with her baby boy. It was probably the first time the fucking thing had been used all semester.
So you see, Skip said when show and tell was over, it could have been any of us.
Deary slowly raised his head. All that remained of his flush was a single red patch over his left eye. It looked like a blister.
Why are you lying for him? He asked.
He waited, but no one answered.
Not one of you had a peace sign on a single thing before Thanksgiving break. I'd swear to it, and I bet most of you never had one on anything before tonight. Why are you lying for him?
No one answered. The silence spun out. In it there grew a sense of power, an unmistakable force we all felt. But who did it belong to? Them or us? There was no way of saying. All these years later, there's still no real way of saying.
Then Dean Gerritsen stepped to the podium. Deary moved aside without even seeming to see him. The dean looked at us with a small and cheerful smile.
This is foolishness, he said. What Mr. Jones wrote on the wall was foolishness, and this lying is more foolishness. Tell the truth, men. Fess up.
No one said anything.
We'll be speaking to Mr. Jones in the morning, Ebersole said. Perhaps after we do, some of you fellows may want to change your stories a bit.
Oh, man, I wouldn't put too much trust in anything Stoke might tell you, Skip said.
Right, old Rip-Rip's crazy as a shithouse rat, Ronnie said.
There was strangely affectionate laughter at this.
Shithouse rat, Nick cried, eyes shining.
He was as joyful as a poet who has finally found Limoges juste.
Shithouse rat, yeah, that's old Rip.
And in what was probably that day's final triumph of lunacy over rational discourse, Nick Prouty fell into an eerily perfect Foghorn-Leghorn imitation.
I'll say the boy's crazy, missing a wheel off his baby carriage, lost two or three cards out in his deck, fellas a beer short of a six-pack.
Ease.
Nick gradually realized that Ebersole and Gerritsen were looking at him, Ebersole with contempt, Gerritsen almost with interest, as at a new bacterium glimpsed through the lens of a microscope.
You know, a little, sick in the head, Nick finished,
losing the imitation as self-consciousness, that bane of all great artists, set in. He quickly sat down.
That's not the kind of sick I meant, exactly, Skip said. I'm not talking about him being a cripple, either. He's been sneezing, coughing, and running at the nose ever since he got here. Even you must have noticed that, dearie.
Dearie didn't reply, didn't even react to the use of the nickname this time. He must have been pretty tired, all right.
All I'm saying is that he might claim a whole lot of stuff, Skip said. He might even believe some of it, but he's out of it.
Ebersole's smile had resurfaced, no humor in it now.
I believe I grasp the thrust of your argument, Mr. Kirk. You want us to believe that Mr. Jones was not responsible for the writing on the wall, but if he does confess to having done it, we should not credit his statement.
Skip also smiled, the thousand-watt smile that made the girls' hearts go giddy up.
That's it, he said. That's the thrust of my argument, all right.
There was a moment's silence, and then Dean Gerritsen spoke what could have been the epitaph of our brief age.
You fellows have disappointed me, he said. Come on, Charles, we have no further business here.
Gerritsen hoisted his briefcase, turned on his heel, and headed for the door. Ebersole looked surprised, but hurried after him, which left Deary and his third-floor charges to stare at each other with mingled expressions of distrust and reproach.
Thanks, guys!
David was almost crying.
Thanks a fucking pantload!
He stalked out with his head down and his folder clutched in one hand. The following semester he left Chamberlain and joined a frat. All things considered, that was probably for the best. As Stoke might have said, Deary had lost his credibility.
So you stole that, too? Stoke Jones said from his bed in the infirmary when he could finally talk.
I had just told him that almost everyone in Chamberlain Hall was now wearing the sparrow track on at least one article of clothing, thinking this news would cheer him up. I had been wrong.
Settle down, man, Skip said, patting his shoulder. Don't have a hemorrhage.
Stoke never so much as glanced at him. His black, accusing eyes remained on me.
You took the credit, then you took the peace sign.
Did any of you check my wallet? I think there were $9 or $10 in there. You could have had that, too, made it a clean sweep.
He turned his head aside and began to cough weakly. On that cold day in early December of 66, he looked one fuck of a lot older than 18.
This was 4 days after Stoke went swimming in Bennett's Run. The doctor, Carberry his name was, seemed by the second of those days to accept that most of us were Stoke's friends no matter how oddly we'd acted when we brought him in, because we kept stopping by to ask after him. Carberry had been at the college infirmary, prescribing for strep throats and splitting wrists dislocated in softball games, for donkey's years, and probably knew there was no accounting for the behavior of young men and women homing in on their majority. They might look like adults, but most retained plenty of their childhood weirdnesses as well. Nick Prouty auditioning Foghorn Leghorn for the Dean of Men, for instance. I rest my case. Carberry never told us how bad things had been with Stoke. One of the candy stripers, half in love with Skip by the second time she saw him, I believe, gave us a clearer picture, not that we really needed one. The fact that Carberry stuck him in a private room instead of on men's side told us something. The fact that we weren't allowed to so much as peek in on him for the first 48 hours of his stay told us more. The fact that he hadn't been moved to Eastern Maine, which was only 10 miles up the road, told us most of all. Carberry hadn't dared move him, not even in the university ambulance. Stoke Jones had been in bad straits indeed. According to the candy striper, he had pneumonia, incipient hypothermia from his dunk, and a temperature which crested at 105 degrees. She'd overheard Carberry talking with someone on the phone and saying that if Jones's lung capacity had been any further reduced by his disability, or if he'd been in his 30s or 40s instead of his late teens, he almost certainly
would have died. Skip and I were the first visitors he was allowed. Any other kid in the dorm probably would have been visited by at least one parent, but that wasn't going to happen in Stokes' case. We knew that now. And if there were other relatives, they hadn't bothered to put in an appearance. We told him everything that had happened that night, with one exception, the laugh-in, which had begun in the lounge when we saw him spraying his way through Bennett's run, and continued until we delivered him, semi-conscious, to the infirmary. He listened silently as I told him about Skip's idea to put peace signs on our books and clothes so Stoke couldn't be hung out all by himself. Even Ronnie Malenfant had gone along, I said, and without a single quibble. We told him so he could jive his story with ours. We also told him so he'd understand that by trying to take the blame or credit for the graffiti now, he'd get us in trouble as well as himself. And we told him without ever coming right out and telling him. We didn't need to. His legs didn't work, but the stuff between his ears was just fine. "Get your hand off me, Kirk." Stoke hunched as far away from us as his narrow bed would allow, then began to cough again. I remember thinking he looked like he had about 4 months to live, but I was wrong about that. Atlantis sank, but Stoke Jones is still in the swim, practicing law in San Francisco. His black hair has gone silver and is prettier than ever. He's got a red wheelchair and looks great on CNN. Skip sat back and folded his arms. "I didn't expect wild gratitude, but this is too much," he said. "You've outdone yourself this time, Rip Rip." His eyes flashed. "Don't call me that." "Then don't call us thieves just because we tried to save your scrawny ass." "Hell, we did save your scrawny ass." "No one asked you to." "No," I said. "You don't ask anyone for anything, do you? I think you're going to need bigger crutches to haul around the chip on your shoulder before long." "That chip's what I've got, shithead. What have you got?" A lot of catching up to do. That's what I had. But I didn't tell Stoke that. Somehow, I didn't think he'd exactly melt with sympathy. "How much of that day do you remember?" I asked him. "I remember putting the fuck Johnson thing on the dorm. I'd been planning that for a couple of weeks, and I remember going to my 1 o'clock class. I spent most of it thinking about what I was going to say in the dean's office when he called me in. What kind of a statement I was going to make. After that, everything fades into little fragments." He uttered a sardonic laugh and rolled his eyes in their bruised-looking sockets. He'd been in bed for the best part of a week and still looked unutterably tired. "I think I remember telling you guys I wanted to die. Did I say that?" I didn't answer. He gave me all the time in the world, but I stood on my right to remain silent. At last, Stoke shrugged, the kind of shrug that says, "Okay, let's drop it." It pulled the Johnny he was wearing off one bony shoulder. He tugged it back into place, using his hand carefully. There was an IV drip in it. "So you guys discovered the peace sign, huh? Great. You can wear it when you go to see Neil Diamond or fucking Petula Clark at Winter Carnival. Me? I'm out of here. This is over for me. If you go to school on the other side of the country, do you think you'll be able to throw the crutches away?" Skip asked. "Maybe run track?" I was a little shocked, but Stoke smiled. It was a real smile, too, sunny and unaffected. "The crutches aren't relevant," he said. "Time's too short to waste. That's relevant. People around here don't know what's happening, and they don't care. They're gray people, just getting by people. In Orono, Maine, buying a Rolling Stones record passes for a revolutionary act." "Some people know more than they did," I said, but I was troubled by thoughts of Nate, who had been worried his mother might see a picture of him getting arrested and had stayed on the curb in consequence. A face in the background, the face of a gray boy on the road to dentistry in the 20th century. Dr. Carberry stuck his head in the door. "Time you are on your way, men. Mr. Jones has a lot of rest to catch up on." We stood. "When Dean Gerritsen comes to talk to you," I said, "or that guy Ebersole..." "As far as they'll ever know, that whole day is a blank," Stoke said. "Carberry can tell them I had bronchitis since October and pneumonia since Thanksgiving, so they'll have to accept it. I'll say I could have done anything that day, except, you know, drop the old crutches and run the 440.
We really didn't steal your sign, you know, Skip said. We just borrowed it. Stoke appeared to think this over, then sighed. It's not my sign, he said. No, I agreed. Not anymore. So long, Stoke. We'll come back and see you. Don't make it a priority, he said, and I guess we took him at his word because we never did. I saw him back at the dorm a few times, but only a few, and I was in class when he moved out without bothering to finish the semester. The next time I saw him was on the TV news almost 20 years later, speaking at a Greenpeace rally just after the French blew up the Rainbow Warrior. 1984 or 85, that would have been. Since then, I've seen him on the tube quite a lot. He raises money for environmental causes, speaks on college campuses from that snazzy red wheelchair, defends the eco-activists in court when they need defending. I've heard him called a tree-hugger, and I bet he sort of enjoys that. He's still carrying that chip. I'm glad. Like he said, it's what he's got. As we reached the door, he called, "Hey?" We looked back at a narrow white face on a white pillow above a white sheet, the only real color about him, those masses of black hair. The shapes of his legs under the sheet again made me think of Uncle Sam in the 4th of July parade back home. And again I thought that he looked like a kid with about 4 months to live, but add some white teeth to the picture as well, because Stoke was smiling. "Hey, what?" Skip said. "You two were so concerned with what I was going to say to Gerritsen and Ebersole. Maybe I've got an inferiority complex or something, but I have trouble believing all that concern is for me. Have you two decided to actually try going to school for a change?" "If we did, do you think we'd make it?" Skip asked. "You might," Stoke said. "There is one thing I remember about that night, pretty clearly, too." I thought he'd say he remembered us laughing at him. Skip thought so, too, he told me later, but that wasn't it. "You carried me through the doorway of the exam room by yourself," he said to Skip. "Didn't drop me, either." "No chance of that. You don't weigh much. Still, dying's one thing, but no one likes the idea of being dropped on the floor. It's undignified." "Because you didn't, I'll give you some good advice. Get out of the sports programs, Kirk. Unless, that is, you've got some kind of athletic scholarship you can't do without." "Why?" "Because they'll turn you into someone else. It may take a little longer than it took Rotzi to turn David Dearborn into Deary, but they'll get there in the end." "What do you know about sports?" Skip asked gently. "What do you know about being on a team?" "I know it's a bad time for boys in uniforms," Stoke said, then lay back on his pillow and closed his eyes. "But a good time to be a girl," Carol had said. 1966 was a good time to be a girl. We returned to the dorm and went to my room to study. Down the hall, Ronnie and Nick and Lenny and most of the others were chasing the bitch. After a while, Skip shut the door to block the sound of them out, and when that didn't entirely work, I turned on Nate's little RCA swing line, and we listened to Phil Oakes. Oakes is dead now, as dead as my mother and Michael Landon. He hanged himself with his belt right around the time Stoke Jones was going high profile with Greenpeace. The suicide rate among surviving Atlanteans has been pretty high. No surprise there, I guess. When your continent sinks right out from under your feet, it does a number on your head.